720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for spending part of your Saturday afternoon with me. I am most grateful to you for that. It's starting to look a little bit cloudy out there, so we're going to keep you updated on all the weather. We'll be checking in up in the newsroom throughout the program. But in the meantime, we have so much to talk about today, so very many things. We are starting off the program with our friend Emily Aries. She's the founder and CEO of Bossed Up, which is an innovative personal and professional training organization that helps women create sustainable careers. Welcome to the program, Emily.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. I like you already. I'm an Aries, and so by virtue of that being your last name already, we're fast friends. So tell us a bit about Bossed Up, and then I want to talk a bit about a piece that you have currently at ChicagoTribune.com. But tell us a bit about the organization first.
Sure. Well, I started Bossed Up to help people get out of the cycle of burnout. I really believe we have a burnout work culture here in the United States especially, and I help women in particular overcome that and craft happy, healthy, and sustainable career paths instead. Frankly, this is something I went through myself. I completely bottomed out and burnt out in my first leadership position as a state director helping President Obama pass federal health reform back in 2009. And I firmly believe that if women in particular had the support personally in our lives and made ourselves personally a priority, that we would see more women leaders on par with our male counterparts. And frankly, we'd make the world a better place.
Amen. I'm going to just drop the mic and walk away now. That's good. I like
that's
it.
That's what we do at Bossed Up, is really make it tactical and practical. I'm a research junkie and a bit of a geek. So I like to take all the social science out there and, acknowledging the imperfect, unjust world that we operate in, provide really tactical, practical solutions that women can put to work for them in their lives and careers right away.
That's really excellent. Well, and so there's a piece that you have that's up right now at ChicagoTribune.com, and it is about networking without wasting each other's time. And this caught my eye and my heart and my mind right away, because I think networking is so fraught, and you break it down in steps, but I kind of want to talk about it philosophically first, because, you know, I think there's a lot of pitfalls with networking that are just icky, that are just not good.
Yeah.
And, you know, totally. I think one of the main ones, and the one I run into the most, is that people are not really making the ask or being particularly clear about what it is they want. I mean, if someone says,
sure,
I want to break into broadcast and I would love for you to listen to my demo reel and give me feedback, just say that. But instead,
hey,
what's up? How are you? And like, no.
Yeah. Can you copy and paste your success into my life? I know. It's a troubling conundrum, but I think it stems from part of the fact is that we don't always know what we need to get to where we want to go. Mm. So to take a step back, networking, first and foremost, as a term, I'm pretty sure it's widely maligned, right? Nobody wants to go to a networking event. That doesn't sound fun or enjoyable to pretty much anybody. So I really wrote this article from a place of being a community organizer. My background is in community organizing, which really comes down to bringing people together to achieve a common goal. And when you look at your own career trajectory in that lens, if you look at it as, I want to join forces with other people who can forge relationships that are mutually beneficial to both of us along the way. Not only are you going to be seen as a resource and someone who can be supportive to others, like right off the bat, regardless of age or experience or what have you, but frankly, it also reduces that power paradigm of thinking, I'm the one who's needy here, I owe you my life because you're the one with the resources and power, and, you know, by your good graces, you might be willing to give me a little bit of insight along the way. I don't think that power dynamic sets us up to have really authentic friendships or relationships cultivated along the way. And I firmly believe that networking is a stupid term, right? Obviously, we need, in the age of social networks, our networks, so to speak, are broader than they've ever been. What the world needs more of and what your career will benefit from are real relationships. And that's what this article is about, is how to go about cultivating authentic, mutually beneficial relationships so that no one has to get their brain picked, because literally nobody wants to be in that seat. It is not a fun position.
Yeah, I mean, that always kind of makes me cringe a little when I, like, hey, let's meet for coffee so I can pick your brain. Like, well, what? Ooh. I need my whole brain. Yeah. Please don't pick it. Don't pick it. But you want to be right. helpful. You know, I mean, I had access to great mentors early in my career, and they were so valuable to me.
And I
appreciate the role of that. But I think a key thing is that mutual benefit that you mentioned. And it's not just, hey, mm-hmm. please bestow some mercy on me, this young right. person starting out or making this change that you've done. I think if you approach it with that mutual benefit, I think it really, sure. it flips the script a lot. I mean, there's a coding program that I've heard about that it pairs young women who are very proficient in web web programming languages with mid-career mm-hmm. women who want to learn how to code, but already know how to navigate nonsense and office politics
sure.
and do that. And so
sure.
they work together and they both have a task. Like, I'm going to teach you how to navigate office politics and how to move up in the corporate ladder. And you're going to teach me how to code. That's a pretty good deal.
I love that. That's such a wonderful example of this theory in practice. And I don't want to come down too harshly on those who are seeking job advice or who are in the job search. That is not a fun place to be. So it makes sense that sometimes we see ourselves as desperate or vulnerable when we go into these meetings,
sure.
when we're hoping that some amazing person who we really idolize will spare a little time and some information and maybe some assistance to help us on our way. But what it boils down to really, if we get to the heart of the matter here, is self-worth.
Mm-hmm.
When you go into a meeting like that, or even start to craft that email asking for that meeting, if you come from a place of solid self-worth and say, you know what, this person is busy and important, yes, but I am important too, and if we can come to the table together, how can I see myself as being of help to that person as much as they're going to be of help to me?
Yes.
When you come into that conversation with that grounded sense of who you are and why you want to achieve what you want to achieve in this world, it becomes bigger than just you. This isn't you asking for help. This is about you creating the impact you want to create, and maybe that person wants to help you create that impact too. That creates an opportunity for taking shared action on shared values.
Absolutely.
And at that point, you actually are perceived as having more authority. You're perceived by that important, busy person as basically having your stuff together, to put it mm-hmm. you know, nicely for
yeah.
the radio.
For radio. Yeah.
Right? You're perceived as having a strong idea of what impact you want to have on this planet and why. That is much more motivating. When I see someone email me saying, can you please help me get a job in politics? That's one thing. But if they say, here's where I come from, I really want to help other people like me, get healthcare access because I firmly believe that this is the cause I want to devote my life to. Holy moly, right? That's a whole different frame asking for the same kind of support that motivates me to say, hell yeah, I want to be a part of this person's journey. I want to be a part of making that impact in this world too.
Yeah, truly. My friends, we're talking with Emily Aries. She is the CEO and founder of Bossed Up, and she has got some great tips for us on how to network without wasting each other's time. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about what those steps are, because you know what? Networking is kind of icky for a lot of people. So we're going to bust that up, make it cool, make it fun, make it all about relationships of mutual benefit. It's the human-to-human business model that I'm always talking about, my friends. We'll be right back just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today and sharing part of your Saturday with us. We are most grateful to you for that. My friends, so much to talk about here still on the show. Lots to do, so please settle in and stick around. We have been talking with Emily Aries, the founder and CEO of Bossed Up, which is an innovative personal and professional training organization that helps women create sustainable careers. And we've been talking about networking, because I think when we hear that word, we go, oof, networking. I got to go to this thing. I got to go to this event, do this thing, do the schmoozing. But you know what? It doesn't have to be all that. We can revolutionize networking. I'm convinced that we can do this. And we can make it a lot more human and make it really all about human beings helping each other. And it's really all about that mutual benefit. So there is a great piece that Emily has created that is on chicagotribune.com that you can go check out. But I'm hoping she will walk us through the steps a little bit, because there are some great steps that she's kind of broken it out for us so we can... We we can make networking a little bit less of a drag and not so much about wasting each other's time, where we can just be honest and human with each other. So the list starts, Emily, with leading with a story. So tell us what you mean by that and how we can do it in a very authentic way.
Sure. So let's assume in this scenario that you've already landed that meeting or phone call and you're on with someone you really admire who can help you get to where you want to take your career next. The first way to start that conversation off is not to tell me about your achievements or rattle off your resume. Instead, tell me a story of where you come from and why you care about this stuff. Tell me something that actually illustrates your values. In practice, don't tell me you care about helping others succeed. Tell me what you've done that demonstrates that. And that's kind of a tricky thing to learn, so I put together a video all about how to tell your personal story, which people can watch at my YouTube channel. The YouTube username is BossedUp.org. And really, it goes into greater detail there about how do you tell a story of where you come from, why you care about this, and make that connection into step two here, which is how does this other person who you're speaking with fit into that picture? And so if we want to talk about next steps, Amy, I'm happy to dive right into that step two in this article.
For sure. Yeah, let's keep rolling.
So the second piece of once you've introduced yourself, obviously these conversations are not one-way performances. So as soon as you can, you're going to want to ask leading questions to learn about the other person. And really, the underlying goal of your questioning should be better understanding why they care about what they care about. Why did they choose to go into broadcast journalism? How did you get here? You know, why do you care about these issues? And obviously there should already be a sense of the overlap if you're meeting with this person about a networking or potential job prospect. But really learn about the human that you're talking to. What makes them tick? What are their frustrations? And you might uncover ways that you can be helpful to that person. For instance, I had a meeting with an amazing New York Times best-selling author who I admire greatly, who focuses on women, work, and workplace and family policy issues. And when I sat down with her, I not only had a chance to talk with her about the issues that we both care greatly about, but it came to light that she was having some trouble, not with her dogs, which are happening to me right now, but she was having some trouble with her personal website and really developing the technology piece to her work, which is something I happen to know a lot about. So when you inquire and really start asking questions and actively listening as much as you're talking, you'll actually uncover what values you share with the person across the coffee table and how you might be able to help them as much as they might be able to help you.
And that overlap is something you describe in your article as aiming for that magic X of that sort of where the Venn diagram meets, it sounds like.
Exactly. And it's all about thinking about person A and person B have shared values, right? So identifying those values that we share, like say we both care about advancing issues relating to women in the workplace, and divergent or different resources. So I might have some expertise on email list management and website development that could help that author. And she had some really great insights to publishing and book writing, which is one of the goals that I'm working on right now. So it's great to meet people you so hugely admire and then uncover your shared resources and where they intersect with the various resources you both bring to the table.
Excellent. I super love that. And then next on this list is one that I talk about so much on this program, and I've already even mentioned it here in our time together, and that is about making a clear ask, really just asking for what it is that you're looking for.
Yeah. I mean, it's so funny because it can be really scary to be the one asking, mm-hmm. but the important thing to remember is that people want to help. On the whole, people want to see you succeed. And if they don't, you really don't want to be building a relationship with them anyway,
right.
frankly.
Right.
So with going in with that assumption that people want to help, we also know that people are overwhelmed and crazy busy. So A, don't just ask once if you're getting turned down or your emails aren't getting responded to in a timely fashion. But B, go into this meeting with a couple of different asks that you have in your back pocket. You might uncover new resources that you didn't even know that person has that you can ask them to bring to the table. Like, hey, can you introduce me to your book agent? I didn't realize you had a great book agent you loved until we had this conversation. But, you know, notwithstanding the idea that you can develop your ask along the way, you also want to go in with some backups, with a clear sense of, okay, if I don't learn anything new about this person by the end of our, let's say, 20 to 30 minute long coffee, I'm going to ask her if she can introduce me to other women in this field or other people in this field that she recommends I reach out to. Having a solid, concrete, measurable, you know, actionable takeaway is not, it's not something to feel bad about. It's actually a courtesy to the person who's spending some time helping you try to get to where you're going.
I love that. And then, of course, the follow-up, the very, very important follow-up that's so essential to any interaction. You got to follow up. And not only do you have to follow up, you need to follow up and give the things you promise. That's a very key thing.
Exactly. Exactly. So I always try to, in my business, I'm constantly partnering with other incredible people in the space. So we're constantly co-hosting events or featuring people as guest writers on our blog at bossedup.com, or putting together free resources and webinars and all sorts of freebies for people to take home and take action with. When I end a meeting with someone who I'm discussing a potential collaboration with, I always like to say, well, here's what I'm committing to. I'll get you these things by, you know, let's say the end of the week. And here's what you've said yes to, right? And whenever we can be diligent, not just about documenting that, but in all that critical follow-up that comes afterwards in the form of a thank you email and making good on your promises, that's where the real magic is. That's where people either learn to trust you as someone who stands by their word and actually delivers on what they say they're going to deliver, or someone who has the best intentions but maybe isn't that organized and is never going to follow up, which can really leave all that good relationship building work you did over that meeting, it can really sour the entire relationship you've started to build. So have empathy for the crazy busy people who might not be on top of following up, especially if they're giving you something that you've asked for. And do the follow-up work for them. Make it easy for me to help you. And some of the mentees that I've had over the years have done such a tremendous job, not just in reminding me of what I asked for and or what they asked for and what I said yes to, but also in telling me how things turned out. I love hearing from the women I coach or train or mentee, oh my gosh, here's what's happened. You've been such a support along the way. I want to let you know I'm now working full time in the, you know, areas that I'm passionate about. So let me know if I can ever return this favor.
I love that.
Critical.
Yeah, very, very critical. Lots of good stuff here. Emily Aries, founder and CEO of Bossed Up, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Amy. Take care.
All right. Have a great Saturday. All right, my friends, we're going to take a quick break and then get you up to news and all that good stuff and then be back with more goodies here on the Wintrust Business Lunch in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today and sharing part of your Saturday. We're going to keep you updated. We're going to keep checking in with the newsroom upstairs about that weather that's going to be rolling through. So stay tuned for that. We will keep you updated as things progress on that weather. But still lots to do right now on the Wintrust Business Lunch. We're joined now by Elizabeth Dwoskin, who is the Washington Post's Silicon Valley correspondent. Hi, Elizabeth. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us today. You know, we have talked a lot on this program about Silicon Valley. We've talked a lot about China, but there's a story that you have up at WashingtonPost.com right now that brings those two pieces into focus together that was so interesting. I knew I wanted to talk to you as soon as I saw this piece. And it's really all about how China is flooding Silicon Valley with money. But there's stuff that can go wrong. There's risk involved in that. So kind of break that down for us a bit.
Sure. Thanks for, I'm glad you like the story. So China, the headline of the story is China's flooding Silicon Valley with cash. And this has been a vast, but I think poorly understood trend of the last 2 years. Chinese money, you know, and Taiwanese money has been in Silicon Valley intermittently as far back as the semiconductor boom of the 80s. But in the last 2 years, you have billions of dollars of Chinese capital coming into Silicon Valley. And the reasons for that are myriad. They have to do, of course, with China's growing wealth. You have giant Chinese internet companies that are international companies in their own right, Alibaba, which is like the Amazon of China, Baidu, which is the Google of China, Tencent, which is like the Facebook, Twitter, and Snapchat of China all in one. And they have a lot of money to spend and are really looking to grow their innovation. And then you have a lot of wealthy individuals. And then you also have the recent instability in the country, economic instability, which is pushing cash out of the country. So just the way there's been a lot of foreign money in bonds and real estate, that's had a huge effect on the tech boom as well. So in the last 18 months, there's been like double the deals of the years before, $6 billion in the last 10 years. I think we calculated about $3 billion of that in the last 18 months. So it's had a huge effect on the tech boom.
Certainly. And I think, you know, what is perhaps a little, I think there's a lot of mystery around Alibaba in particular. You know, I think a lot of people know that name, know kind of vaguely what it is, but I don't think I don't think there's a great awareness around how, like, the reach of Alibaba, because it is so giant and so well funded. There's so much money to play with there.
Completely. And I think Americans don't understand Alibaba now, but I think we will in the future. Because if you talk to people in places like Brazil or Egypt, and they're using e-commerce, they're not using Amazon. They're using Alibaba. Alibaba wants to be an e-commerce company. Wherever there's an emerging market with a growing middle class that wants access to foreign goods, they're using e-commerce, and they're using a platform like Alibaba. So it's a huge company, and it's growing, and it's extremely hungry and extremely ambitious. So the story that, you know, and there are culture clashes, and there are risks to doing business with anyone. My story focuses specifically on the culture clash with China that has come about as a result of this flood of capital. And my story looks specifically at a deal that went south with Alibaba. And you can sort of take some lessons from that for the wider tech community.
Yeah, well, tell us a bit about that culture clash, because I found that part of the story very, very interesting.
So you have to think about, so China, you know, Chinese are like many people, have been trying to get in the tech boom in the last couple of years. Companies like Uber and Snapchat, both of them have a lot of Chinese money. Palantir has a lot of Chinese money. You know, they're outsiders to the clubby world of Silicon Valley. And so there's always a concern that you're going to be treated like dumb money. You're going to be treated as naive. You're not going to get access to hot deals, and you're not going to get access to the early rounds of companies. You had a company there was a company called Quixie, and what they do is they do mobile search. So they have technology which helps you search with inside apps. Turns out searching inside apps is much harder or much different technologically from a Google search. So they've had this cutting-edge technology, and Alibaba invested in them. But what happened over time was that there was a dispute, and Alibaba stopped paying them. And the question is why. And from Alibaba's end, the company didn't deliver on time. They didn't send in the product that they were going to do. They were doing a lot of custom work for Alibaba, and they were going to actually share revenue in China. The other version of the story, though, is that they were contractually obligated to pay them, but they didn't. And they had a lot of big organizational shakeups within the company. You have these giant companies that are very political, that have ties to the government, and there's big shakeups. And the American companies on the other side working with them don't always understand that the sense is that you're getting jerked around. That's the experience on the other end. So what Quixie felt was that they were obligated to be paid, and that was something that you wouldn't see even if a deal goes south with other companies, that you wouldn't see such extreme behavior. And yet it all happens behind the scenes because, like most things in the tech world, people are incentivized to cover up things that went bad.
Right. That is a key thing, like a key narrative, I think, that emerges in every conversation we have on this program and many others about when we talk about Silicon Valley, is it, there's, you know, we have to be so aware of that, of that cover and all that. You know, what I think is interesting, too, about this story is that I just think we still are not talking enough about the very interesting and rampant class issues that are happening in Silicon Valley. You know, we often talk about Silicon Valley problems that are, you know, things things like the Uber for helicopters and Uber for private planes, you know, things like that that are really just like not practical problems, but things kind of invented for Silicon Valley class issues that are not as practical outside of Silicon Valley. So I think when you start throwing international pieces into it, it gets even more and more interesting, I think. And then when we start talking about the kind of money that we're talking about, I mean, as you note in your story, investment from China into Silicon Valley, excluding real estate, which is in itself a whole other show, topped $6 billion by the end of the first half of, right? I mean, that's an unbelievable amount of money to spend in 18 months. That's a huge amount of money. So, I mean, we're talking
about a small tech, you know, the tech economy is small relative to the wider economy. Like $6 billion going into startups, it is a big deal. You know, it's very small relative to the amount of foreign money and Chinese money coming into the United States overall. But it's very large when you look at like a tech sector, which is why a lot of startups told me, you know, that's totally changed the game for startups and for startup fundraising, because you always feel like there's a Chinese investor who will give you money even if you couldn't get it from an American investor. That comes out with a lot of problems because the Chinese investors don't want to be treated. So there's just an interesting, and then there's also the hunger. Like, you have to understand the hunger for these Chinese companies, individuals to grow and get it away from low-end manufacturing into advanced manufacturing innovation is very, very hungry for that, very ambitious. And so you sense these global ambitions.
It is really so interesting. Right. I think that hunger, that eagerness for partnership with the Chinese market is so clear. I mean, I think that comes out so clearly. I mean, I think that's a very sometimes publicly conveyed milestone that a lot of young startups get to, that when they take that step, it's news. It's something they talk about really openly because it seems like an achievement. But this is really, really interesting. All of the stuff that you've covered in this story, I think, particularly the cultural part, I think is so fascinating. So everybody head to WashingtonPost.com, check out this story. China is flooding Silicon Valley with cash. Here's what can go wrong. It is a really fascinating read with a lot of really thoughtful points made in it by Elizabeth Dwoskin. She is Washington Post Silicon Valley correspondent. Thanks for being with us today, Elizabeth.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks so much. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break and get you news here in just a little bit, but still plenty more to do on the Wintrust Business Lunch before we get there. So we'll be back in just a bit on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thank you for sharing part of your Saturday with me. I'm so grateful to you for that. I know that you have many, many options. So thanks for tuning in. Still plenty to do here on the show. There is lots going on in the retail world, of course, because we've already started seeing Halloween stuff up and back to school stuff up has been up for like a month. And I'm sure in another week, Christmas stuff will be up because that's how retailers roll. But there is a conversation that is very, very interesting that our next guest has started in the Chicago Tribune. You can check the story out at chicagotribune.com. It is all about how big retail is really trying to use that moment of back to school shopping and turn incoming college kids into lifelong customers. And so here to talk with us about that story is Lauren Zumba from Chicago Tribune. Hi, Lauren. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Amy. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. So talk us through this, because I think there's so much interesting strategy to retail that sometimes is frustrating, especially when it tricks us. But nonetheless, very, very smart people with many advanced degrees really put a lot of thought into retail and getting consumers to not only just make the purchase now, but to get that brand loyalty and to become customers for life and really, really have that brand affinity. And so what is it that big retail is doing right now to help to lock in people as they're going into college and doing that back to school shopping to help make them customers for life?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of things going on. And, you know, if you think about it, if you're talking about developing someone as a lifelong customer, there's a lot of reasons that college is a great time to start that process. You know, it's one of the biggest, or for a lot of retailers outside of the holidays, it's one of the busiest times of year. And if you think about, you know, a kid going off, outfitting their first dorm room or, you know, first apartment for an upperclassman, you know, there's a lot of stuff they need to buy. But also, you know, a lot of kids probably haven't done a lot of household shopping before they go away to school, so might not already have a lot of, you know, built-in preferences for the stores they like to go to, or, you know, don't already have a lot of habits around shopping like that. And college is also a time when, you know, they're starting to form those sort of lifelong preferences.
Right. And I have to think that having a positive retail experience when you're that age and making some of your first adult decisions that are pretty exciting ones, you know, shopping for going off to school is an exciting time. I've got to think that
stressful, but exciting. Yeah,
right. Definitely. But nonetheless, I think that there is, I agree with you. I think there's a huge opportunity for retailers right then to really have a very positive shopping experience there for the customer. And I think what is really fascinating, what you note in your story, the average family will spend $888.71 getting each kid ready to go back to campus. That's a lot. I mean, that's probably pretty easy for some families, and it certainly as compared to tuition, that's
sure.
That's pretty small. But nonetheless, you know, most people don't have $1,000 just sitting around. So you know, and we see families. I know I ran an errand the other day and saw a family, and they were really, really stressing over this towel purchase, and it was really about, but I want this towel, but that towel's really expensive. Can you just, it's going to get lost anyway. Can you just make do with this one? And there was so much conversation going to the price versus quality of this towel. And it was so interesting just to hear them going, not that I was eavesdropping, but I was.
Well, right. And there's a lot of decisions to make like that. And so that's where you see, you know, some of the retailers that, you know, obviously that's a lot of money and everyone wants to get their chunk of that. But some of the ones that might be taking, you know, more of a longer term view, thinking about that long term loyalty, that's where you see some of the more engaging attempts to talk to students, whether that's, you know, having, you know, school by school recommended a college shopping list on the website, or, you know, a college expert that you can book an appointment with to, you know, help you go around and figure out what you need.
Right. So you talked to some of these retailers. I think Container Store has probably done that for a while. I recall getting their catalogs for that kind of thing for years. But it looks like Bed Bath & Beyond is also doing something similar to this.
Right. Bed Bath & Beyond does a lot around college. Target also has a lot of programs. You know, some of them are things that they've done for quite a while, you know, where it's the sort of checklist and, you know, providing more info about what people need. But there's also some newer options, whether that's, you know, hosting parties at stores they have near college campuses. So after normal closing hours, they bus all the kids out, sort of show them where the store is. There's a DJ around. In the coupons for a potential return visit, or, you know, one of the other new things that they're doing this year is they have it's the first time Target's using a chatbot. So a little messaging app where sort of a different way for students to shop using social media and, you know, can talk and get suggestions for things that they might want, shop directly within it.
Right.
And because for some of the retailers too, they're also trying to figure out how that next generation wants to shop,
right,
and wants to buy things going forward.
Yeah.
And it's a way to reach a lot of them all at one time when they're all looking for, you know, the same sorts of products.
Yeah. I mean, I think it is an interesting opportunity, right, to learn how, you know, because if you're entering college right now, you're not millennial, you're Gen Z, you know. And so
right.
I think people say millennial is a catch-all for anybody like younger than us. But in fact, no, you know, millennials are starting to turn 35. Millennials are well over drinking age. It's Generation Z is starting to turn 21 and going to college and getting out of high school and all that stuff. And so there's a big learning curve. People need to learn, you know, what's happening there and how that generation uses technology, how they shop, how all of those things. So one thing I thought was very interesting in your story was the note about Amazon, about the on-campus stores where students can pick up and drop off packages, which sounds really interesting, especially just for the not having to schlep things part, but, you know, but also just to learn how people will interact with a drop-off station like that.
Right, right. And, you know, college is a great place to try that out too, because, you know, delivering to campuses is already pretty hard. If you think about a lot of students living in one dorm building, there's not a lot of convenient spots. So, you know, on the one hand, it probably actually is easier for Amazon and for the students. But yeah, you know, it's also, learning a lot about that new group of customers that might not have a lot of disposable income now, but, you know, they're probably hoping we'll be shopping more down the line. And also, I was talking to I spoke with a marketing professor at Northwestern about this, who said that, you know, from Amazon's perspective, it can be kind of hard to convince someone who's, you know, been shopping at brick and mortar stores all their life that, you know, just getting everything off the internet mm-hmm. is the way to go.
Sure.
But someone who hasn't had that experience and, you know, isn't used to doing that already, you know, might be an easier sell on that being a more convenient way to go.
Right. You can certainly form new habits with new shoppers. I think it's really, really interesting. Well, thanks very much for talking with us, Lauren Zumba from Chicago Tribune. You can read about this story, all about how big retailers are trying to turn college kids into lifelong customers. Head over to chicagotribune.com and read all about it. It's a really interesting story. Thanks very much for joining us, Lauren.
Thanks, Amy.
All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break and get you over to news and then to King John and all that good stuff here in just a bit on 720 WGN. Oh, that's us. Let's do this. Let's talk about some things. You know what, my friends? I fibbed to you. I had no idea. John Williams is off this weekend, and our good friend Matt Bubala is in.
Better than John Williams.
I'm not going to say that on the record.
Oh, but it's true.
I mean,
you said it off air. John Williams had his Teddy Roosevelt show today.
Yes, he did.
So we're going to check in with John before his show is over.
Excellent. I'm sure it's going swimmingly.
It should be over by now.
I'm sure it went swimmingly.
I'm sure it did. Yes. Hi, Amy Guth. How are you?
Hi. I haven't seen you in ages.
I know.
What do you have coming up on the show today?
Well, Heidi Stevens from our Chicago Tribune is coming in. She has a
Love
great
her.
Piece. I think it's going to be in the Sunday Trib. It's already online, about whether our teenagers should work during the school year.
Did you?
I started working. I had a paper out when I was like 12 or 13.
Yeah.
I was working at a gas station when I was 14. And I don't think I ever really went without a job from then on. And I've always been surprised as I've gotten older, how many friends, you know, older friends I've had with kids older than ours that didn't work. I know kids that didn't work into college.
No way.
And I was always stunned by that. And a lot of it was travel sports have gotten out of control. And
mm-hmm.
we do so much of that.
Sure.
But if my kids aren't playing a sport or doing something, they're going to be working once they're ready to do it.
I was informed the day after my 14th birthday that I had a job.
Excellent.
Working for my dad.
That's how it starts.
And I have continuously been employed since.
That's great.
So I spent one day at 14 unemployed, and I haven't been unemployed since. Knock on wood.
Did dad start you on a 401k right away? Is that...
All those things.
Really?
Yeah.
Look at you.
Like, you will save this much of each check, and you will do this, and hey.
You know, it's funny. We do that to our son, Jack, who's just turned 15 this summer. He umpired all last year mm-hmm. for our Little League and made like $700, and we just put it all in his account and didn't let him touch it.
Don't tell him.
He's very bitter about it. Oh, no, he knows. He's very upset. That's not fair.
Right. You'll thank us one day.
Well, you get to use the whole life is not fair, Jack.
Yeah, that's a good one.
It's terrible to get old and do that to your kids. I feel... like really old when I turn into my parents, but I enjoy it so much.
I bet.
Adam Richman, you remember Man vs. Food?
Love him.
He's got a show called Secret Eats now.
Yeah.
He's going to tell us what they're doing on that show this year, and he'll tell us his favorite places to eat in Chicago.
I follow him on Instagram, and he has not yet followed me back, so feel free to give him a little bit of grief.
I will give
that.
Him a hard time. He probably has a lot of people following him.
He probably
him on Instagram,
doesn't care if I follow him on Instagram.
He will once he gets to know you.
Exactly.
Thank you, Amy Guth. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com, the 1 o'clock news, sponsored by TimeshareExitTeam.com. Let's get upstairs to Susan Berkus.